Who's Talking with DZ Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. When you hear about fox hunting, you think of an upper class sport, maybe in England or maybe in Virginia. But I've learned that fox hunting is popular all over the country, and it's especially popular among a group of people here nearby in Chapel Hill who are members of the Red Mountain Hounds. And I've used the occasion of best-selling author Rita Mae Brown's visit to promote her brand new book, set in the country and in the sport of fox hunting, to come tell us about the book. And then we've invited my old college friend, Bruce Dalton, to come talk to us about some of the local angle. So welcome, Bruce, and welcome, Rita Mae.
Thank you, DJ.
Rita Mae, you came to visit us last year with one of your series, a book called The Hunt Ball, and we learned a little bit about fox hunting and about how bad things happen in Virginia in and around the fox hunting, and how good people who are fox hunters are able to solve these mysteries. You got another one for us, don't you?
I do. And they're great fun for me to do. I mean, for one thing, fox hunting has a dual image. One is that we're all these terrible snobs, you know, and the other is that we're hell's angels on horseback. And neither one is exactly accurate. So for me to be able to write the series and have the response I've had, it's nice to see that people are getting a more accurate picture of a sport that's really a beautiful sport, just physically beautiful, as well as it takes a certain amount of guts to do it. It's not for the faint-hearted, and the fox always wins, so what could be better?
And what do you mean the fox always wins? The fox is hunted down. I got all these dogs and people and horses and everything running after this one little fox.
They're so smart. They make a fool out of you. I mean, they really do, and we don't kill them. In England, they do, but they have different agricultural practices, and I'm not here to defend them or to put them down, but we don't kill them. We don't need to do it, and we couldn't even if we wanted to. They have too many ways to get away. But it's interesting for me because we've become so arrogant, humans. We really think we're the crown of creation, and fox hunting will disabuse you of this notion very quickly.
In what respect, Rita Mae, that is it?
You literally get outfoxed. I mean, it's not a joke. You do. They're able to process information so much faster than we are. And remember, we have screens between us and reality. We have religious ideology. We have political ideologies. People have a hard time seeing reality. And we have language. Language is logical. Life is not. The fox has none of those problems. And whatever that circuitry is in the brain, it works faster than ours.
So as a writer who makes her living with words, are you saying that our ability to communicate in language by writing and speech is a handicap to us that the foxes don't have?
It can be very much of a handicap. If you think about it, the greatest emotions are always inexpressible. What we can talk about is the easy stuff.
So you and I would have, I mean, not just to push you on this, you and I would have a different and maybe a richer experience getting to know with each other if we only communicated with the kind of body language and wagging tails and things that the fox have, ears going up and down.
Well, they certainly have a greater range of communication than we do. I mean, we can't move our ears. We can't lift the hackles on the back of our neck. We can't throw off scent at will. I'm convinced a fox can. I don't know what but I think they can. And we've become so reliant on language now that we've even forgotten how to read our own body language. I mean, all you have to do is watch the mating dance to watch people miscue time and time again because they don't know how to read the body language. A fox never makes that mistake.
Wow. Well, would you tell us a little bit, what will you tell us about your new book?
Well, I'll tell you, you have to run down and get it. I love these books, well, because I love fox hunting. And I mean, the question is, why does a writer write about fox hunting, but how did I wind up being a writer? Because I fox hunted in my mother's womb. No, really, I did. She was pregnant out there hunting with Green Springs Valley. What interests me about this book is the way the characters are deepening and developing and their relationships and some are sharpening too. But what kicks this one off is an odd event, which is a congealed ball of blood that's found in the snow, but there's no bodies and there's no footprints. And as the book goes on, then there's another one. And of course, there's a murder, and I can't tell you about that because I can't spoil it. But I had a lot of fun.
Well, there's a bowl of blood. There'd better been a murder around in there, unless somebody's just donating it.
That's part of the twist of the plot. And because it's frozen, it takes place in snow, it's literally this beautiful congealed ball of blood. Blood is actually a very pretty color. But it doesn't make any sense. And when the hounds find it, they know it's human, because the long nasal passage can warm up scent even on a cold day, which we can't do. We're too short. So they know it's human. And they know there should be a body, but there isn't.
So the hounds who are trained to find the scent of foxes, that's what they're, what they learn to do, can also kind of on their own find the scent of a human scent, and if properly directed, go try to find more of that scent.
A hound can smell anything. The difficult part, at least for me, I can't speak for your pack, is you need to keep them on the correct scent, and that's part of the real work of fox hunting, is that they don't go off in deer, or they don't get off on a bear or whatever. And when the deer are in rut, you have to work extra hard, which, of course, they're going into right now in Virginia. I think foxhounds have the third best noses. Bloodhounds are first, bassets are second, foxhounds are third.
What are foxhounds genetically? And how are they, just how are they kin, I use this word with caution or with worry, but how are they different and how are they like other dogs?
Well, hounds are one, you know, there's these different breeds. When you watch Westminster, you see the working dogs and you see the herding dogs, et cetera, et cetera. Hounds are divided into sight hounds and scent hounds. Fox hounds hunt by scent. So if a fox walked in front of a Red Mountain hound or one of mine, they're not going to pay any attention until they can smell it. They might look, but they're not going to hunt it until they actually get the scent. That's what makes scent hounds so fascinating.
So that would be different from a hunting dog if I went dove hunting or if I went hunting in the water for waterfowl. It would be, these are sight hounds, these?
You're talking about sight hounds and the scent hounds. The great advantage of a scent hound is it might be able to pick up a scent that's 2 days old, depending on the conditions, where the sight hound is always reliant upon the game being right there at that moment.
So we think of the foxhounds as one of that category, and you mentioned the bloodhounds. These are the guys who help our law enforcement people track down criminals. Is that right? I mean, is that by scent they go out in the woods and if I'm trying to escape from prison?
But it's a bitter heritage for a Southerner because they were also used to track
slaves. To track slaves as well.
So it's hard to celebrate.
Well, I'm not going to give up on you're telling us a little bit more about your books and the story. It's the fifth maybe in a series. You write lots of different series of books, but this one, your book, The Hounds and the Fury, sequel is not the right word, I guess, but it's a part of a series of books that in which the same characters, and we've gotten to know the characters and we can get to know them again. Tell us about some of the characters who we meet and see in many of your books.
I will, but actually, you know, you could too, because they appear in every hunt club.
Really? Okay. Oh, it's really?
They do indeed.
Of course, they appear in any group of people. I mean, you know, there's always the one who thinks they know more than they do, you know, and then they're timid ones, and they're the ones that actually are good soldiers. You know, they really believe and they get into it and they're helpful. And then there's the behind the hand gossip, you know, the people that always stir the pot and make trouble. And then, of course, you have this here in Chapel Hill quite a bit, and we're getting it in even my county. We have what we call the come-heres, the folks that come on down from north of the Mason-Dixon line, and they love everything about us, but then they want to change us. They don't like the country.
Get us organized.
A hound walks across their 5 acres, and they're calling the sheriff. They're just having a fit and falling in it. It's like, hey, if you come here, if you want to be in the country, then be country. Otherwise, get your butt back across the Mason-Dixon line and leave us alone. You
know? So those characters populate your books as well as Bruce's read. Well, we better not put you on the spot, Bruce, about these kind of characters.
I don't think we quite have those characters, but I sure have seen all of them in the hunt field every time. And we don't have any bodies either in the hunt field.
So far, we've done no murders yet. Well, Rita Mae, again, let me press you, because one of the engaging characters and your hero is the sort of the leader of the of this fictional club that you have organized, whom we call Sister.
Right.
Tell us about her
now. Sister, as you know, is a Southern term of affection. And she's 73, which is not particularly old for a fox hunter. Mrs. Moss went until 98, master of Moore County Hounds down in Southern Pines. 70s are really nothing. You start to worry a little bit about somebody when they're in their 80s, maybe. So she's strong and she's tough because she's hunted all of her life. She's used her body. In fact, in this book, she decks a man who's 30 years younger than she is. And I have seen it almost happen. You don't mess around with a big woman that's 6 feet tall, you know what I mean? She's a natural leader. I personally love older people because they're the ones with the stories. And also, you know, by the time you're even in your 40s, you are disabused of the notion that you're the center of the universe. Now, maybe you're not if you're Madonna, you know, and you're in your 40s and you're, but you know what I mean. Most of us at some point realize that we have to pay attention to other people and that they probably really do know more than we do about certain things. And she's still learning. That's another thing I love about this character, as was Mrs. Moss.
Well, and Sister also has, although she wouldn't brag about it, she has some intelligence about finding criminals. I mean, about sorting people out and what they really are.
And she's logical, but she uses her senses. Remember, she's a master. She has to work with people. A master, the skills of a master are the same as being in Parliament in Britain. You're always building bridges. Unfortunately, that is not the same that you need in Congress. But you really need those skills in a parliamentary system, which is why when a man wanted to run for Parliament from the Shires in the old days of England, he tried to be a master of foxhounds.
Wow.
So she has these skills with people, but she's also able to read her environment. She's not deluded by ideology or language. She relies on her senses.
Like the fox.
Yeah.
Or like the hound.
She can't be drawn off the scent as easily as another person by easy explanations. You know, she's got that nose. She knows something's wrong. And she also trusts her hounds.
Well, listen, we need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Bruce Dalton about the Red Mountain Hounds, and we'll be right back.
What can you expect when you go for a dental visit at Dr. Teresa Robinson's office? When you arrive, you'll be greeted cheerfully by a wonderful staff, and you won't spend a lot of time in a waiting room. You can expect state-of-the-art equipment, a full diagnostic, and an open dialogue about the health of your mouth. With all the latest advances in technology, you can be sure to receive the best quality dental care. And all new patients are eligible for a complimentary whitening. Call Dr. Teresa Robinson at 403-5559 to schedule your appointment. Who's Talking with D.G. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Rita Mae Brown, who has written, Rita Mae, the fifth, is that right?
The fifth
book in a series of books set in fox hunting country and among fox hunting clubs. And Bruce Dalton, you are a member of the Red Mountain Hounds. Tell us about how what Rita Mae's been telling us comes to, you know, how it affects what goes on in North Carolina.
Well, it's absolutely exactly the truth that we see here in our hunt field also. You know, most folks don't recognize fox hunting in North Carolina like they do in Virginia. We don't have the same heritage there. You know, people ask me why I fox hunt. And I say I fox hunt basically for four reasons. I love the tradition that goes with it, because fox hunting is really an awful lot of just tradition. And we talk about the clothes
you all dress
wear.
Up, don't you? I mean,
we're
you
all
dress...
dressed up. We're dressed up funny, and we go out in the politest group of folks you've ever seen while they're on horseback. Now, it may not be the same later, and it certainly isn't in Rita Mae's books necessarily. But we all are dressed up, and we all follow certain traditions. You follow traditions in terms of selecting your masters. I wish all of us could be, you know, Sister Jane Masters. She's the master in the sky, as far as I'm concerned, and a master all of us wish we could be. So I certainly enjoy Rita's made a picture of her in her novels, because I enjoy
reading
those.
You got these traditions. That draws you to the...
Tradition is incredibly important to me, and I think a master's responsibility is to uphold the tradition first. And then second, I think it's to maintain the sport, which includes bloodlines. We've talked about hounds. You have American foxhounds up in Virginia, and they're well-suited for open areas where you have big gallops, fences. You can see what's going on. Here in North Carolina, we have much tighter areas. They're what we call cover. These are little stands of trees with open areas between, or even deep into the woods. So we have a very different kind of hound here. We have a pack of called Penn Merrydale hounds developed out of the Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware area, hence Penn Merrydale. They're a hound known for the nose. They will spend an awful lot of time working scent. So, as Rita Mae said, they're not visual hunters at all, and they will stay with the scent that's been around a long time, and they have the most beautiful deep voices you've ever heard. So when
like,
they,
what does he sound like, Bruce?
I mean, DG, there is no way I can tell you what a pack of foxhounds sounds like. You just have to come out and experience it. But I'll guarantee you this, you'll get goosebumps. It is the most beautiful sound you've ever seen. And watching these hounds figure out a trail, you know, when we talk about fox hunting, we don't actually hunt the fox. As Rita Mae pointed out, we hunt the scent of the fox. And you get on the scent, and I have a whip who works with...
This is one of the a job in the club.
It's a job in the hunt. We call them whippers in, and their job is to assist the master, assist the huntsman in controlling the hounds during the hunt. And I have one, Rob Millet, who says, at the end of every cold trail is a hot fox. And I think that's always the way you have to have it. So we hunt the fox scent. So sport is very, very important. Fellowship is important. We have fun, which is probably the most important part of fox hunting. We enjoy being with each other. We like getting out. There's such a misconception about who fox hunts. It is considered by many people to be an elitist sport, and it's not. Anyone,
what do you mean it's not elite? I mean, you all dress up in these costumes that look like, you know, you're going to a formal dance or you know, going to Parliament. I mean, and you've got all the expense of having, I mean, it costs a lot of money to have a horse. I mean, how can you say that it's an egalitarian sport?
Well, because we dress up funny. Football players are not considered to be elitist. Neither are the adults running around dribbling in their pants, the basketball players. So, you know, I don't think you should look at our clothes and say it's elitist. And the
it's a uniform then.
It is a uniform based on tradition and usefulness. Everything we wear has a purpose, and I won't take the time to go through that here. But it does indeed have a purpose.
Well, give us an illustration, because I mean, why would a bright red coat, you know, that looks like a formal tuxedo sort of thing. Why would that be? What would that have to do with the what purpose could it possibly have?
Well, it's more than purpose, and it's also tradition. The red coat is called a pink coat. And that's P-I-N-Q-U-E.
Oh, I wondered about that. Okay.
I was sure you were wondering about
that. Well,
I was
because Rita Mae said that she wouldn't wear the pink coat without the permission of the master.
Is correct. And it's only worn by staff.
But I was looking. I'd never seen a pink coat before.
Well, you're wearing a pink shirt today, so we certainly could put you in a pink coat. And it's called a pink coat because...
But it's really red.
Red, but it's P-I-N-Q-U-E, because it was named after the tailor who happened to have some of this cloth left over in England. and a hunt came to him, I think, and said, this is tradition anyway. Rita may not agree, and said, we want some coats made for members of our hunt staff. And he said, well, I have these bolts of red cloth. And they said, is it cheap? And he said, yes. And they said, okay, we'll make you some coats. So it's called a pink coat. It's cut so that when it's raining, it'll protect you and the saddle and the horse, so it has length to it. The red coat has turned out to be very, very important for members of the staff because you can see them out there. You know where your folks are. You know where the hounds are. Now, members of the field, with very few exceptions, do not wear a pink coat. It's only the masters and staff and some invited male members of
what
the
would
hunt.
What would the rest of the hunting party wear?
Generally, you're dressed in what we call a black Melton. It's a dark blue or black coat. Now, hunts, you have permission of the masters. They can wear different colors. And do you have a gray coat in yours, or do you wear black?
I do. We're allowed to wear Confederate gray.
Yeah, I thought so. You know, hunts can set out the colors of the coats they wish to wear. The traditional is the black Melton coat or the pink coat to be worn by staff or male members who have been given the privilege of wearing it, based on service to the hunt.
Wow. Well, all right, so and just to review, you got tradition, you got fellowship, you got
sport. And the sport is this wonderful coming together of horse and individual mounted, looking at hounds doing what they have been trained to do and bred to do for centuries here in the United States and elsewhere, and then working on the trail of a fox. And seeing this all come, I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it, DJ. And then seeing this all come together on a run, a chase that takes us and Sister Jane and everyone over jumps and through fields and inevitably ends, with the fox going to ground. Or, as 2 weeks ago, we had a wonderful, wonderful occasion that I have never witnessed in many, many years of fox hunting. We were running a gray fox here, in fact, up at the Quail Roost property, on Grand Hills, a wonderful farm. And a whip was appropriately stationed in the woods and saw this fox come right across in front of him on the trail and disappear. There was no earth around. There was no evidence of ground, and we looked up.
Now, ground means that the fox going underground.
The fox den, yes, where the fox goes into his hole and can sit there and, as Rita May knows, will thumb his nose at the hounds. This fox was 40 feet up in the tree on a limb. Now, I've seen foxes go up on bent trees before. I have never seen one climb an absolute straight tree. It's the one hunt I can say, and I think Rita may understand this, the one hunt I can say that every member of the field viewed the fox.
Because
we brought everyone who was riding their horses, which we call the field, as well as all the staff, gathered around the tree with the fox up there looking down beautifully. And it happens to be at our website if anybody wants to look at it, redmountainfoxhounds.com. And then blew, quote, go to tree on the horn looking at the fox. So we had a wonderful, wonderful day.
Wow. Well, now, all right, now you say you never kill the fox, but what about this one? This one's treed and got the hounds and everything. This one didn't get away, did it?
No. After blowing gone to ground or gone to tree, we move the hounds off and the fox is there for another run.
Wow.
You know, it's the run. It's the chase that's important. That's what we look for. It's not...
I thought about this. We need to take a break, but I thought about it. You know, some of the... primary schools have outlawed playing tag because it's dangerous. And you think when you see children chasing each other for no purpose at all other than this love of the chase, and you say, we're going to take that away from them too. You know, I mean, it's just so. But y'all are children in that respect that the fun of the chase is part of what drives
fun them. Of the chase, being on that horse, watching those hounds work, being with others, and following the tradition brings a lot of pleasure to the hunt.
Well, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk to Rita May about Rita May Brown about her latest book, The Hounds and the Fury, which she's promoting as she visits Chapel Hill again. And we're using this occasion to learn a little bit more about fox hunting from Rita May Brown and from Bruce Dalton, who's associated with Red Mountain Hounds, a local fox hunting group. And Rita May, before we take a break? Okay, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I just wanted to amplify what he said about the coat.
Hey, Dad. Can I borrow the car?
Those are the seven words every parent hates to hear. But worry no more. The Mark Vitale Agency has the absolute best rates for families with young drivers. If you have a driver in your home with less than 3 years driving experience, then the Mark Vitale Agency can help you. Let one of their professionals design a policy to protect your family and save you money. They also have many new discounts to save you money on your homeowner's insurance. Did you know that you can save up to 17% on your auto insurance if they insure your home? Call today, 933-4000. The Mark Vitale Agency, nationwide's number one auto insurance writer. That's right, the company's number one auto insurance writer. Call today, 933-4000. The Mark Vitale Agency, a member of the Mark Vitale family of agencies. Call 933-4000 today and let them help you save money. If you're outside of Chapel Hill, call 321-AUTO. That's 321-2886 for an agency nearest you. The Mark Vitale family of agencies. They know insurance, so you don't have to.
I'm Mike Hannis, principal of Carolina Friends School. True story. The mother of two new CFS students came in hoping to enroll her third child right away instead of waiting till next fall as planned. Why the change? Seems the third child had heard her sister complain that the only problem with CFS is that there's no school on the weekends. Not the first time we've heard that students eagerly attend CFS. That doesn't mean it's all fun and games here. It's simply that we put a good deal of effort into making serious learning fun. One measure of our success? Last year's 36 graduates had offers of over $2 million in scholarships and an acceptance rate at our state's most selective public university that would make any school proud. You just can't make this stuff up.
Like to learn more about what a Friends School education can mean to your child? Attend an open house at our Durham Early School for families of children ages 3 to 6 this Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. For more information, go to cfsnc.org.
Who's Talking with D.Z. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. Rita Mae Brown, the author of The Hounds and the Fury, which is her fifth book in a series of books set in fox hunting country. And, of course, Rita Mae writes all kinds of other books, and I wish we had time to talk about them. But we're into fox hunting today, and you were waving your hands as we talked about the clothes.
I wanted to amplify something my fellow master said, which was about the pink coat. Thomas Pink was the tailor, and he still that business is still in operation today. And in fact, they even have a shop now on Park Avenue in New York City. But what's so funny about it is, remember, General Washington was a passionate fox hunter and had his own pack. And after the Revolutionary War, he really didn't want to call these coats red because it reminded him of having to shoot at red coats. So he asked that you call it scarlet or pink, and we honor General Washington, not just
wow.
Thomas Pink. The other thing is Washington had a pack, some of which blood is probably in your pack.
Absolutely.
It was shipped to him by Lafayette. It's a long story about Washington's two packs. The first pack he gave to George Mason when he went off to take command of the forces, and Mason had such fun with him, he wouldn't give him back after the war. So Lafayette sent Washington a pack of blue tick hounds. And they were said to have voices like the bells of Moscow, which is what Penn Marydales have. These incredible voices. My American hounds have cry, but not the kind of cry he's got. The tradition is also fun. You know, you find out about these things, and it's just so much fun. And the people that did it, Balzac, Twain, I mean, the people that are fox hunted, we could sit here forever talking about them. And so many writers and so many military people. Patton had his own pack of foxhounds. And I think, the connection between military and fox hunting is pretty obvious. They say this is like a cavalry charge without the bullets. But also it demands discipline. It can be dangerous, and you have to face it. There's no whiners in the hunt field. You're excused if you whine.
You mean you're dismissed?
You certainly are. If and you're there, shut up and do it.
How do you dismiss a troublemaker or a person who doesn't contribute to the camaraderie or to the business of the hunt?
Because Bruce and I are the masters, and there's a Yiddish expression, a fish stinks from the head first. And if we don't take charge and remove people that will spoil it for everyone else, And it isn't, and you said it was expensive. It can cost about the same as golf if you have a set of titanium gloves. It doesn't have to be that expensive. But people get up in the morning and it's frozen and they're braiding their horses' manes and they're cleaning and they're getting themselves together. They put an enormous amount of effort in that. You're not going to let one person spoil it.
But how do you do the job?
You simply say you're excused and you're the master and you never argue with the master. It's a feudal structure. The master has utter power. And if you don't accept it, get out.
So the master says simply to someone after the hunt that where he or she has been not a contributor or a disruptor, and maybe on several occasions, just those words.
You're excused. You usually say that in the hunt field, like if they're a danger or maybe their horse is tucked up and they don't know it, which means the horse is exhausted.
And does it mean you're excused from this hunt or you're excused forever from the fellowship of the club?
If you're excused forever, they'll say you're excused forever.
But if you just say you're excused, it means go home and get it together and come back next time with a better attitude about it.
Oh, but gee, I have to step in here. This is a very, very rare occasion, except in the novels. I mean, I think that generally the fellowship brings us all together in fox hunting. And the dashes that you describe so beautifully in your books, which we all thrill in reality don't occur that often when you're out fox hunting. We don't have these very long run jumps where you're holding on for dear life and praying you'll be on at the end. I've done that many, many times. But, for example, in our club, we have three separate groups when we go out and hunt. We have the first flight that goes out, and it is expected to stay up with the hounds and the masters and go for it and jump the jumps. We have the second flight, which it's a little optional. You've got a young horse out. You're not sure of yourself. You don't have to jump everything. You can go around, and then we have the group that my wife and I lead, which are called the Hilltoppers. And this is for individuals that are not going to go out and gallop around because of whatever. Green horses, a young horse that hasn't been out, a young rider. We have five-year-olds that come out and hunt with us and are well-mounted and well-turned out. They ride with us. We have we see more foxes than anybody else does generally except the staff. So I don't want Rita May to say that, my goodness, it's a group that you get out and it's contentious. It's not, except in your novel.
Well, no, it isn't contentious, but occasionally you will have a problem and that person has to go, whether the person's the problem or the horse is. Remember, the hounds come first, and you have to be silent in fox hunting because you don't want to lift the hounds' heads. If people,
if they hear you talking, that disrupts
their concentration. Mm-hmm. The same as if we were in here and somebody walked through the door and interrupted us.
Well, how does the master or the person in charge of the hunt communicate with the field or with how are directions given?
I know what Red Mountain does, but we will generally have before hunting starts is a little clinic to brush people up on their skills and introduce new people to the etiquette because you don't want to spoil the hunt. If the hounds lose the scent, you don't have a hunt. And they realize, well, you know, you're not being quiet because we're draconian. You're being quiet because it's part of the sport and makes for better sport and stuff like that. And people are very smart. They get it pretty quickly.
Now, year before we go out, we have a newsletter. In fact, it went out 3 weeks ago to remind all the members of the field about etiquette in the field, what we call order of go and who has priority. Specifically talk about right away of the hounds and quietness. And Rita May is exactly right. Half the beauty of fox hunting is listening to what's going on, whether it be silence or whether it be hounds working and not talking to each other. We ask people never to speak louder than in a voice that can be heard by the person next to you and never speak when hounds are speaking or working very, very close to you because it's extremely important. So We try to tell them right up front what's expected. And Rita May is right. Every now and then, well, I shouldn't say every now and then, almost every hunt, I'll have to say, quiet, please. So the folks behind me, if I've got a group or the other masters, will make it very clear, you should not be talking at this point. Is this fun?
Doesn't somebody carry a horn?
The huntsman carries a horn. And I think Rita May can certainly speak to that.
Right. I carry the horn. I actually have my grandfather's cow horn. I don't carry it, though. I carry the traditional little horn. But it's musical. So the hounds, and the fox, too, recognizes the notes, as do the made hunting horses. One of the funniest things in the world is to watch a green person on a made horse, and you hope they have the brains to buy a made horse. The horse recognizes what's going on. You'll see those ears going around, and the person doesn't have a clue. And when the huntsman blows gone away, the horse takes off, and there's the person rocked back. They have no idea what happened.
So the hornsman, or what do you call it? The huntsman has the horn, right. And the huntsman has a signal to mean, let's go. And what other signals would it?
You have signals that it's called draw the cover or lure in there. It's Norman French. The words that you use came to us really about 1066 when Harold got the arrow in the eye. It's lazy Latin. That's an easy way to describe it. But you'll say lure in there, or you'll blow the horn. There's a series of notes. If the master here's gone away at third flight, he knows he's got to tighten up his group and get ready to roll. If you blow gone to ground, it's very joyful. It's sort of these little wiggly notes, you know, and the hounds are excited and you're excited and all this and that. And a mournful call is gone to ground, going home. And when a fox hunter dies, you blow gone to ground at the head of the casket.
Oh, wow.
Or put in the ground.
We need to take a break. I'm talking to Rita Mae Brown. We're talking maybe more around her new book, The Hounds and the Fury. And we're also talking to Bruce Dalton and been learning a lot about fox hunting. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
East West Partners, the developers of Meadowmont, would like you to know that a limited number of homes are still available. What exactly do we mean by limited? A few, more than one or two, not a lot. Which means for a limited time, emphasis on limited, you have limited opportunities to live, work, play, shop, dine, even retire in Meadowmont. Now, assuming you completely understand the limited part, visit Meadowmont.com today. Meadowmont.com. Because while supplies are limited, demand is not.
Congratulations to the Barbecue Joint in Chapel Hill for being recognized as the best in the Triangle 3 years in a row by Independent Magazine's Reader's Poll.
Mm-mm.
I can taste that mouth-watering barbecue right now. Ribs, barbecue catfish, crab cakes, fried green tomatoes, hush puppies, steak fries, just about anything your taste buds desire. If you want to know what's on the menu, you've just got to come on by the Joint because their fresh food menu changes daily. Haven't been yet? Well, get on down to the Joint. The Barbecue Joint on Weaver Dairy Road in Chapel Hill. WCHL 1360. Time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins. Brought to you locally by the Cedars and East West Partners Community.
He was a workaholic who made his fortune by giving others new ways to play. His story on the next Biography for Radio.
Sweet! I've been waiting for lunch all day.
Me too! Natalie, I'll trade my apple for your potato chips.
I don't know, Matthew, my potato chips for your cookie.
Let's see. Billy, what's that?
Rich chocolate Ovaltine.
Rich chocolate Ovaltine?
An apple and my gummy bears for the Ovaltine?
No way.
Potato chips and grape juice for the rich chocolate Ovaltine?
No way.
Two cookies, bubblegum, and my Hershey's chocolate milk?
Double no way.
Aww. More Ovaltine, please.
Until his death at age 78, the visionary entrepreneur was always busy. In his lifetime, he windsurfed, scuba dived, skied, played tennis and golf. At work, he was booked up a year in advance. When he was born in 1921, his parents made plans for him to run their sake brewing firm. But he had his own ideas. At the age of 25, he co-founded an engineering company. The Second World War was just ending, and people were hungry for little luxuries. The young businessman set out to fill this need. He changed his company's Japanese name to one that Americans could pronounce, and began to turn out novelties like a small pocket radio and home video recorder. As the company grew, he defied his own executives. In the 1970s, he observed how teenagers always had music on, at home, in their cars, at the beach. He told his engineers to devise a portable tape player with headphones. The idea of shutting yourself off horrified his directors. Music, they insisted, was a sociable thing. He cheerfully ignored them, and the Walkman became a hit worldwide. Today, it's the best-known legacy of Sony Corporation founder, Akio Morita. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by the Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at the Cedars of Chapel Hill. Who's Talking with D.Z. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Rita Mae Brown, the author of The Hounds and Fury, the latest in her series of books about fox hunting and fox hunting country, and only peripherally about murders and mysteries and all that. And Bruce Dalton, who is active in the local fox hunting club, or one of the local fox hunting clubs, the Red Mountain Hounds, and they've been teaching me about fox hunting. Rita Mae, before we stop, I hate it that we're coming to the end, but tell us a little bit about writing and about the intersection of writing mysteries and the setting in an environment that you love, clearly. Is it distractive to have it all mixed in, or does it help your writing to be comfortable in the environment in which you write?
Well, it helps my writing because I have such a passion for it. I have a passion for literature. I mean, I love Turgenev, I love Tolstoy, I love Tennyson, all the T's, I love Tibullus, you know. I'm excited when I write. I'm excited when I fox hunt. But and to bring them both together is just a joy for me. It really is. And what I find so interesting is when I have to sit down and reflect, I learn anew about hunting. And I have to do research. I can't just sit there and rely on what I myself have experienced. You know, you'll go back to the classic texts from the 1700s and 1800s, and I'll review stuff, and hound bloodlines are fascinating to me, as well as thoroughbred bloodlines. And I'm always learning, from other masters, like Master Dalton. Being a master is one of the most unusual positions a person can find themselves in. It's an honor, it's a great honor, and it's a tradition, and you know you're doing something that was seen on the pharaoh's tombs. You're part of an unbroken line where hounds are coupled. You'll see the friezes on the tombs. They're walked out and coupled. Maybe they didn't have a master exactly as we have, but you're part of something that's so old and such a part of human life. Remember, agriculture's only 10,000 years old. Hunting is what we are. We're medium-sized predators. And so you're part of the most fundamental thing about being human, really, in order to survive, which is to say to eat. And so we've turned it into an art form. We don't have to eat the fox. We don't have to kill the fox. But we are remembering our roots in a way. And I love all that part of it. I love the history. But I love mastership. I have learned so much. I was political all my life. I worked on campaigns and this and that. I have learned more. I have learned more political skills as a master. I have learned more respect for differences among people as a master than I ever had as a young woman working on campaigns.
Wow. So many different directions that we could go in. We do not have time, but you all have got us all so excited about fox hunting. But now, if I get excited about football, I can go buy a ticket and watch Carolina play in Keenan Stadium. If I get excited about basketball and I have enough money to buy from a scalper, I can watch a basketball game. But now, there's just no way I can. I mean, there. I don't see any. There's no ticket sales, or if you got interest, it's not a spectator sport, is it?
Oh, it can be.
Oh, it is a spectator sport.
Well, how would I get to go watch the Red Mountain Hounds doing all this stuff that you've been getting me excited about?
Well, you've got your invitation right now, as well as all the listeners here. We're located 13 miles north of Durham on 15501 in the Roxburgh, close to Roxburgh. A good example was last weekend was our opening hunt. Not only did we have 81 members mounted, which was a very good size field, we had 40 to 60 more following the hunt in their trucks or on our tally-ho wagons, which are hay wagons, and having lots of fun there. And we did everything we could do to make sure our hounds were in full view and full cry of these folks so they could join in with us. Now, I have to admit, we jumped three foxes when we were trying to bring hounds down to the tally-ho wagons, and they went the opposite direction and out of country, and they didn't follow the script. But that's what foxes do. But everyone's welcome. Well, we're considered to be a welcoming hunt.
How do you do this? I know you, so I could call you and you'd tell me exactly what to do and where to show up, and you would have somebody there to take care of me. But if I'm just thinking, golly, I'd like to see one of these. Is the best thing to go to the website, to call, or just show up without warning people? If you get just general advice, what's the best way?
Well, I have to admit, the best way to do it, give me a phone call. And I don't mind putting that over the air, 919-732-7098, and I would certainly then give you the information. It's important to know where we're going to meet, because we don't go the same place every time.
Usually on a Saturday morning, would that be the usual time?
We hunt on Saturdays and Wednesdays, twice a week.
You're hunting during season twice a week?
Twice a week. We go out at 9 o'clock on Saturdays, 9 o'clock on Wednesdays, sometime Wednesday afternoon to accommodate those folks that can't get out Wednesday morning. But if you can get in touch with me, I'll be more than happy to tell you where we are and give you in directions. The directions are actually at the website, www.redmountainhounds.com. Some great pictures there, too.
And if you can't remember that, we'll try to have this up on our website, but if you can't remember the address, if you Googled Red Mountain Hounds, North Carolina, you'd probably run into it.
I think you would end up there, and I think you would enjoy what you'd see.
Well, from a spectator standpoint, what would be the best way to experience it? And Rita, I'd like to hear both. What would you tell your buddy who's never been fox hunting, what to look out for and how to experience it as a spectator?
If a hunt has a footmaster or someone leading trucks, they can help explain. But one of the things you would look for is the pack hunting well? Are they hunting as a team, just like a football team? Is their teamwork efficient? Does the huntsman have good rapport with his hounds? Are the whippers in quiet? If you hear whippers in running around and cracking and hollering all the time, chances are they're probably...
The whipper is the...
That's an assistant to the huntsman to keep the hounds focused on the fox and not stray off. And usually they don't too much anyway. But you can have troubles if you hop two foxes at the same time, which happens. You know, you will split your pack and you want them all hunting the same fox, which is easier said than done. Are the whippers in efficient? Is the staff well horsed? What are they riding? How do they look? Are they well turned out? Is this a hunt that has pride in itself? What are the field members like? Usually they're very hospitable. People will do anything to help someone that's interested in fox hunting. But if a fox bursts out of the cover, watch what happens next. Traditionally, a huntsman should count to 20. If the hounds aren't on that fox right away and your whipper in yells tally ho, you listen to your whipper in first, then you know that fox has burst the cover. Count to 20 before you put the hounds away. You always give the fox a sporting chance.
Well,
the other thing is the huntsman lifting the hounds, which means picking them up and running off somewhere else a lot? Or are they letting the hounds figure it out for themselves? There's a lot of different styles of hunting, just like there's a lot of different football coaches.
Well, guys, I'm so sorry, Bruce. You're not. You're just going to have to call Bruce. He gave you his phone number. But I was going to ask what to read to get introduced, but there's probably no better way to get introduced to the fox hunting sport than to read Rita Mays Brown's book, the latest one, The Hounds and the Fury. And she's come here to talk about the book, and we made her talk about fox hunting. And if you're excited about it, get that book and then give Bruce Dalton a call or visit the Red Mountain. Red Mountain Hunt webpage, www.redmountainhounds.com. RedMountainHounds.com. I'm sorry. Thanks to both of you. What a great instructional and fun time. Enjoyed having Rita Mae Brown and Bruce Dalton as my guest. And thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time
tomorrow.
Pleasure
being with you.
At home, at work, in the car. This is News Talk 1360 WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's News Talk and Tar Heel Station.